In 2010, Project Censored determined that while the U.S. military is responsible for the most egregious and widespread pollution of the planet, that information goes almost entirely unreported in corporate media. Almost a decade later, as Joshua Cho writes for FAIR.org, that observation is still applicable. Two major studies published in June remained buried by most major media outlets. The first, Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change, and the Costs of War, by Brown University's Costs of War Project, confirmed previous findings that the U.S. military is the single largest producer of greenhouse gases in the world, and that the Pentagon is responsible for between 77 and 80% of all U.S. government energy consumption since 2001. The second study, Hidden Carbon Costs of the Everywhere War, Logistics, Geopolitical Ecology, and the Carbon Bootprint of the U.S. Military, published in Transactions of the Institute of British Geographers, found that if the U.S. military were a country, its fuel usage alone would make it the 47th largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, between Peru and Portugal. But these groundbreaking studies received no coverage in virtually all of the U.S.'s biggest papers and TV news channels. Cho's Nexus database search from the start of June through the start of October turned up nothing in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, LA Times, NPR, PBS, ABC, CBS, or CNN. Well, aside from their findings, the studies are significant because they're the first to use comprehensive data based on the publicly available emissions data from the Department of Energy and on multiple requests to the U.S. Defense Logistics Agency. Most greenhouse gas accounting focuses on how much energy and fuel civilians use because it's been difficult to get reliable data on the Pentagon's carbon footprint. They don't publicly report their fuel consumption or greenhouse gas emissions. But despite not signing the 1992 Kyoto Protocol agreement to fight climate change, the U.S. succeeded in obtaining an exemption for all countries' militaries from having to report, let alone cut, their carbon emissions, which Congress later locked in. Although that exemption was later removed by the 2015 Paris Accord, the Trump White House is due to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Accord in 2020, which would make it harder to collect data and conduct future studies. That's why it's especially important for media outlets to cover studies like this when they are published. And finally, when an older presidential candidate is hospitalized after having chest pains, later revealed to be a heart attack, as was the case with Bernie Sanders, you could look at it from a medical perspective, examining what it might mean for the candidate's overall health and how worried we might be about their ability to continue campaigning or to carry out the duties of the presidency, assuming no further complications. A candidate's health is important, as are sober assessments of how serious medical incidents are. It is quite common to experience a heart attack and return to normal functioning fairly quickly. Former Vice President Dick Cheney famously suffered 5, the first at age 37. On the other hand, apparently, you could turn it into ageist musings about whether candidates in their 70s are too old to be president, regardless of the fact that the three top polling candidates in the Democratic race, Sanders, Joe Biden, and Elizabeth Warren, are all in their 70s, and the current president is 73. Is age only a number, even when you're running for president? Wondered the headline over a New York Times piece that presented the question, how old is too old, as a campaign issue, alongside things like health care costs and college affordability, stagnant wages, and immigration. The averages paint a sobering picture, the Times' Lisa Lara reported, despite the fact that averages tell us next to nothing about an individual's health or physical capabilities. Medical experts, on the other hand, could offer useful insight. In fact, the geriatric expert she interviewed rejected the premise of the article, saying that, quote, it's true that rates of physical and cognitive impairment are age-dependent, but there's all kinds of variability. Age should not be a disqualification for the presidency, close quote. Then again, who needs experts when you can cite random voters drawing on their own experience? Voters, the New York Times story said, are not sure they would want to be keeping up such a rigorous schedule in their 70s. Would you? The Hill went a step further, giving a Democratic strategist anonymity to flaunt their ageism shamelessly. Quote, "You can be a young 78, but you're still 78. I think the Bernie news is proof of that. They're all old. Is this really the best we could do?" Close quote. Well, no one would deny that most people in their 70s would not be able to keep up with the demands of the presidency, but most people in their 70s are not running for president. So just as coverage wondering whether female candidates or candidates of color are electable serves to heighten the stereotypes and prejudices that it purports to be passively observing, how old is too old stories draw on tired prejudices that need to be challenged by reporters, not reinforced by them. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.